It's hard for me to not talk politics when I'm on stage doing stand-up because I know the president. And that's my story today. I know the president. I know the president of the United States. He fired me on the Celebrity Apprentice. He screamed at me when he fired me. He didn't scream at the other celebrities. He didn't scream at Brian McKnight. Whoever the fuck that is.
Hello and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. That was Tom Green telling jokes about his time on The Celebrity Apprentice on Comedy Central's This Is Not Happening show last year. Tom has faded from the spotlight a bit in recent years, but he was once one of the most famous comedians on the planet. As I tell Tom in this episode, I was about 14 or 15 years old when The Tom Green Show premiered on MTV, which was probably the perfect age to appreciate his very specific brand of comedy. In this episode, we talk all about that show, his rise to fame, and of course his more recent experience with Donald Trump on The Celebrity Apprentice. Now, Tom has been touring the world as a stand-up comedian and has a lot of other great stuff going on as well. Before we get to Tom, please, I want to remind you to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you think of the show, who you've really enjoyed hearing, and who you want to hear next. So let's go to my conversation with Tom Green.
I became a U.S. citizen about 4 months ago or something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How has it been so far?
It's been pretty good. Yeah. I mean, I've been living here for 20 years, yeah. So I don't see any sort of immediate changes like to my life because mm-hmm. I've sort of been living, you know, as a permanent resident since 1999. Well, actually, no, I guess I've had a green card for 15 years. So, yeah. You know, I moved to the United States in 1999, and, you know, so it doesn't really change anything other mm-hmm. than the fact that, you know, I am officially an American now, so that's pretty cool. I mean, it's nice knowing that I can't get kicked out.
Yeah.
It's nice knowing that I can vote.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice knowing that, I mean, those are the main two things.
Yeah. Any reservations about becoming a U.S. citizen with Trump as president, or did that
no.
factor into your thinking at all?
No. No, because, I mean, well, first of all, I'm still Canadian also.
Mm-hmm. You didn't have to renounce your Canadian.
You're allowed to be dual.
Yeah.
You are allowed to
be
dual citizen with
so
Canada.
So you can escape if
Canada
you need
is
to.
The only country, I think, that you're allowed to be yeah. dual. I'm not sure if that's true, but I know that most countries you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's others you can.
Yeah, I've heard other people. Part of the citizenship is they have to say, "I renounce my,
yeah.
you know, citizenship with."
You
this
do
other
have
country.
To say yeah. that, yeah.
yeah.
But you're allowed to keep your passport
mm-hmm.
and everything.
Yeah. yeah. Well, that's good.
So, you know, it's no, I don't think it really had anything to do with my old boss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was really just a matter of, you know, I've been living here 20 years. I wanted to be able to vote and. You know, I mean, time goes by so fast, right? Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm 47 years old now, and time just seems to go by faster and faster. And, you know, even if Trump did win another term, which he may, I mean, that'll be over pretty quick. I mean, it's not really got anything to do with that. Mm-hmm. I do want to vote. That's, I think,
yeah.
a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be exciting.
Yeah.
Is there anyone you're excited to vote for at this point, or you're still feeling it out?
As far as... As you're making the assumption that I want to vote for the Democrats?
Well, or Trump, or anyone.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but when you said at this point, I guess you meant like who I think
yeah.
is going to
well,
be the Democratic nominee.
Anyone you think can beat Trump?
I mean, the assumption would be correct, but you know, I think you know, I have to wait and see. I personally feel like, you know, Joe Biden probably would be my choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, again, we'll have to see what happens in the
yeah.
campaign. Maybe
yeah.
Trump will say some stuff that's, you know, sways me, my opinion.
Yeah.
Know? I was impressed with his, not to talk politics, but I was impressed with the restraint shown last week on the decision to not, you know, attack Iran after they shot our drone down.
Yeah.
I was surprised and impressed by that. Now, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe they'll attack Iran before this podcast goes live.
Yeah, by the time this podcast goes live, anything could happen.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about your stand-up. You've been headlining comedy clubs around the country and doing a lot of stand-up recently. What have audiences been like? And do you feel like there is a divide between maybe what audiences and fans of yours expect versus what they get when they see you perform stand-up?
It just depends on the fan, on which particular fan you're talking about. I mean, because I started doing stand-up 31 years ago.
Yeah.
But I really, hadn't toured the United States and the world as I am now, like really until about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I've been touring pretty much nonstop the last 10 years. So I have fans that, have been to my stand-up shows before. They know what I do on stage. Probably a significant portion of the people that come out to my stand-up shows are coming out because they know what I do when I do stand-up.
Yeah.
But, and then that being said, if you were somebody that watched my show on MTV or, like my movie, Freddy Got Fingered or Road Trip or some of those things that I've done, I think that, the tone, the style of my performance and my material, I think, definitely connects with people that are looking for something wild and crazy and ridiculous and silly. But I mean, there was always sort of an underlying point to our show, to my television show, and maybe not as pointed as it is in my stand-up, because in my stand-up I do actually talk about social issues and the human condition in a way that is definitely more focused than on the television show, which was, I still think there was an element of the Tom Green show where we were speaking truth to power.
You know?
It just wasn't as, it was being approached in a way a 20-something-year-old would approach it, as opposed to the way a 40-something-year-old would approach it.
What's an example of speaking truth to power on the Tom Green show, do you think?
Well, as a 28-year-old, I sort of felt like I was rebelling against authority and rebelling against, the status quo and the way the media and the way comedy was made even.
Mm-hmm.
You take something like, hanging a painting on the wall of the National Art Gallery of Canada and seeing how long it will stay there. Mm-hmm. To me, that's kind of like, a bit of a send up of, when you're getting chased by the security guard, the power for a 28-year-old skateboarder is the security guard,
Yeah.
The absurdity of the system of the fact that I could hang a painting on the wall and let it hang there all day, in an art gallery, was sort of sending up, conventions and stuff. So, I just think that, but now I'm actually speaking directly about, the way we behave as people, our addiction to social media, how it's messing up our lives and the way we socialize with each other. So I'm actually just talking about these subjects.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. The people who are fans of yours, when your show was on, are obviously older than they were when your show was on, because I think your comedy on MTV really played to a younger audience. And I was probably 14 or 15 when the show premiered, and I feel like I was kind of the perfect age for it. And I loved the show.
A little bit on my last answer, like in context now, you look at the Tom Green show from MTV, and it still holds up. Like, I mean, the pranks and stuff are very much in many ways... technically, executed the way that YouTube and things are pranks are being shot now. Probably the content is actually in some ways still more surreal and weird.
Yeah.
In some of the stuff was very strange. But, at the time, I was very sort of acutely aware of the fact that, like, what we were doing was new. We were taking a video camera and going out on the street and shooting stuff and editing it together and putting it on television in a way that television just wasn't traditionally made that way.
Yeah.
And so that's why it looked, we were in many ways, I felt like we were sort of, I don't like to say this too often, but I felt we were, let's say, I felt we were in some ways kind of mocking television, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even mocking comedy, to be honest with you. So, you know, and I think that potentially may have rubbed some people the wrong way, and even in the comedy industry, because I felt like we were making fun of comedy a lot of the times with my movie Freddy Got Fingered, especially. You know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating that YouTube didn't exist when your show came out, because now, I mean, it seems like tailor-made for, you know, chopping up and sharing online, and now you can find a lot of that stuff online. And now, you know, shows can only exist if they are made that way. And, you know, like thinking about the late night shows, they only succeed if they can make these short clips that people share and everything. So it is kind of amazing that your show was able to be so successful without that outlet, that online outlet.
Yeah. Even so, like some of the things that I think I was rebelling against still completely exist in the same way as they did before now, within YouTube, within social media, because it's really just about the way like people behave in sort of groupthink, you know, in a corporate environment.
Yeah.
You know, like, so, you know, you can be a network talk show making bits that are working on YouTube, but you still got, you know, 10 executives telling you what you're shooting, and you got 100 writers, and you're in this big bureaucracy, and everything gets kind of ends up getting watered down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was kind of what was truly unique about the Tom Green Show on MTV, different than anything that's followed it, was that it really was coming from this pure independent place. You know, the shows that followed it that have been compared to it or that did similar things were not in any way like made the same way as my show was made. Because, you know, to me, it was me editing it myself, fighting the network, even on MTV, you know, whereas after that, you had sort of, it just sort of reverted back to the way television's always been made. You have a group of executives and writers and producers, and they're all sort of in this bureaucracy, and we're going to make a crazy prank show now, you know?
Yeah.
And it ends up just kind of coming, you know, becoming sanitized. And even if it's really crazy and weird, I can see the MTV stamp on everything that came after the Tom Green Show.
One thing that I didn't realize, I think, until I heard you on Pete Holmes' podcast, was that you had already made a lot of this stuff from that first season.
Exactly.
On your own, without anyone telling you what to do.
Exactly.
And then they kind of just let you put that
air. More than 75% of the clips that aired on the Tom Green Show on MTV, like the out on the street clips, they had all been shot before MTV picked up the show. So when the real world implications of that are things like when I was pulling pranks on my parents, like I had found no success when those things were being filmed. I had no money. My parents were worried about my future. They weren't thinking, all right, here he comes again to do another prank for MTV, you know?
They had no idea it would be on MTV.
So like, you know, again, not to talk about anybody specifically, but you know, there was a thing that was in the performance where there was sort of a desperation, you know, because it was like we were just kind of like, I was scared, you know, like when I was shooting all that stuff in Canada, what am I gonna do with my life? What am I gonna do with my life? And there were literally no rules.
So to show my parents how much I love them, I've turned my parents' vehicle into more than just a vehicle. I've turned it into the Slutmobile.
Holy Christ.
You like it, Dad?
Come look at it, Dad.
Go talk to your mother. I'm going to work.
What? What's the big deal?
Not a big deal. I better be off.
It's permanent. Come look at it.
That's permanent.
What do you mean?
I'm out to the police right now.
You like it? Mom. Are you trying to wipe it off? Mom. Well, Mom, what? A dad can't take the bus to work. I'm going to take the Slutmobile to the bus stop. Wow, there's a lot of people at the bus stop. I hope my dad's not embarrassed by his Slutmobile.
Come on, I'll drive you to work.
What? That thing better be washed off of there. I don't know how you got it on there.
It's permanent. It's a present. Dad, don't worry if your neighbors see the Slutmobile. I mean, it's just your Slutmobile.
Yeah, I mean, I think one person who gets compared to you, or you get compared to him a little bit, is Sacha Baron Cohen, who also, you know, has gone out and done these real life things. And I had him on the show a few weeks ago.
Amazing.
And
I love.
Yeah,
him.
And he, but you know, your show predated the Ali G show.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think he kind of claims to have invented this type of reality comedy. But I, you know, it's almost as if I don't know whether he was influenced by you or not, but it was kind of coming up at the same time, you in Canada and him in the UK.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So did you see, when you started to see that, did you see a similarity between what you were doing and what he was doing?
Did I see a similarity? Sure, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I also see differences, and I saw similarities for sure. You know, because at the, you know, like, I think there's a, you know, there's an element of technology changed. Mm-hmm. Okay, so all of a sudden, 90s, late 80s, early 90s, any skateboarder can go get their hands on a video camera.
Mm-hmm.
And that just didn't exist in the 70s.
Yeah.
In the 80s, really. You know, it was really, you know, video cameras were just too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, anybody who could actually afford the equipment, you know, had to be sort of I don't know, mature enough not to do the things that we were doing,
mm-hmm.
you know, because yeah. in order to get your hands on that kind of equipment, you had to have some sort of financial backing, and you know, that would not be given to somebody who was doing things as idiotic as the things that I wanted to do. So that's why all changed at that time. So there was some parallel things happening for sure. I think that, you know, if I can, you know, if he claims to have created it, I'm sure he did create it in what he was doing, you know, in isolation of what I was doing. I think what I feel like I contributed was that I hammered it through MTV.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I got it on the air.
Yeah.
Like, if I had not fought, like, I don't think people really know how much I fought
mm-hmm.
to get the pure integrity of that crazy, absurd insanity that I was doing on the air. They, even after they picked up the show, they didn't want to put it on the air.
Yeah.
And I fought because I'm a stubborn person, and I was very protective of the comedy. And because I fought for it to get on the air in its purest form, the show became a success. Mm-hmm. And once it became a success, that did open the door for shows that came after
me. Yeah. Can you remember, you know, early bits that you got pushback on from MTV saying, well, we just can't air that, and then you pushed it through?
It wasn't even just specific things for you know, it wasn't just like that's too shocking,
mm-hmm.
or it was literally right down to the way the method of production,
mm-hmm.
like so, you know, like I said, I've been doing the show for 5 years when MTV picked it up, and I came in with all of these clips,
mm-hmm.
you know, I probably had close to 1,000 videos.
Wow.
Okay, shot on, you know, decent, you know, quality, you know, mini DV tapes, mm-hmm. and some of it was shot on VHS.
Yeah,
but it was, you know, it was edited professionally, you know, because we had access to good equipment at the public access station in Canada. So we got to MTV, and it almost became, now it was sort of more the argument became about how are they going to re-edit it,
because mm-hmm.
they, you know, they were tightening it up for time, they were shortening things,
mm-hmm.
and so they were sanitizing it.
Right.
And one of the things that they wanted to do was I remember for one example, MTV, that I found surprising and shocking was, I'll give you a couple examples.
Mm-hmm.
One example, when the show, we moved to New York, MTV brought me to New York, gave me an office. There was mm-hmm. an edit bay
yeah.
in the office. There was an editor taking all of my footage that I, you know, brought down with me
mm-hmm.
and shipped down, and they were loading it into the computer and re-editing it. And I would go in every day and see, you know, what the editor had done. And these were my my edits. I'd cut them myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I felt very protective.
You didn't feel they need to be re-edited.
I knew they needed to be tightened up for time because, and I felt like that actually might be not the worst thing in the world because, mm-hmm. you know, now we were in a half hour format and I wanted to cram as much stuff into the show as possible.
Right.
So I did agree with that, you know, because we would, you know, take a 3 minute clip and make it a minute and a half, you know, was probably good. But, you know, now you're into subjective decision making, like what clips, what shots stay, what shots don't stay. And I would walk in the room the first few days of editing, and so I would go out in the street. Let's say, for example, there's a street that one I remember. You know, one of the pranks. I went out in the street, and it's not really even actually a prank. I don't even really call what I did pranks because they weren't really pranks.
Yeah, but
I would go out in the street and I had crutches. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen the bit. I'm on crutches and I'm walking around on the street and I'm falling down and people are helping me.
Yeah.
I'm screaming in pain and everybody's reacting and looking at me like I've, you know, what's this guy doing? And a lot of the theory of the show was, you know, was that it's funnier to see somebody looking at me. You know, like go out and do something weird, but then we'd film the reaction shot
that's
of people.
That's the funny part, not necessarily you falling
it's
down.
It's that person observing.
Yeah, yeah.
So they would cut all the reaction shots out. You know,
because
they
the
didn't
point.
Understand that, like, that's the funny part. And then I'd explain that to them. So I would explain that to the producers, the executives, NBC. No, that's the funny part. The funny part isn't me falling on the ground. The funny part is the person looking at me.
Right.
So then the next day, I'd go back and they'd put some of the reaction shots out, but they would take all. They would always remove any reaction shot of anybody over the age of 30. And they'd say, we have a corporate policy. Nobody can appear on MTV who's over the age of 30. I'd say, but no, but all the funny shots are the old people.
Yeah.
You know, the old lady, the old man, their shock reaction. They're more easily, you know, flummoxed, right?
Yeah.
So then that became hilarious. A major, major battle with, like, you know, me having to literally go into, I hate saying the word literally, by the way.
Yeah.
Me having to go into these huge sort of negotiations to convince them that the funny part was the old person reacting. So that was sort of a fundamental sort of misunderstanding of what the comedy was.
Yeah. Are there, when you look back on your time there, are there any, you know, whether you want to call them pranks or not call them pranks, bits that make you cringe, that make you say like, ooh, I wish we hadn't done that one? Or do you pretty much stand by everything that you did?
I mean, most of the bits before we shot it, we would say, okay, what's the requirement to go and shoot this? And we would look at each other, my friends and I, when we were writing the stuff, and we'd say, well, let's think of something that in 20 years, if somebody asks you, do you regret it? You'll say, yes, I regret it. Okay, let's do that.
So that was kind of the MO.
Yeah, let's think of something that will make us cringe. That, you know, let's try to do something that is the most embarrassing, ridiculous, crazy, strange thing possible. So, you know, because we went into it with that as sort of the you know, the mindset, no, there's not really anything. You know, I always feel like I had a moral and ethical line that I didn't cross, you know. I never wanted anybody to be, you know, ridiculed in a way that was, you know, if you take a step back and you get out of the heat of the moment, I think anybody that appeared on camera, once they step back, realize what was going on, they're not actually offended by it. You know, like I never really wanted to take, you know, I don't consider any of the pranks that we did or the, I call them pranks now because people call that stuff pranks.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really pranks, you know, because it wasn't hidden camera. I consider the definition of a prank as a hidden camera.
Yeah.
Bit.
You never hid the camera.
We didn't hide the camera. Yeah. So any of the clips, we called them segments is what we called them.
Right. Right.
But any of the segments we did, you know, or the videos we did, you know, I think most people that appear on camera in those bits, like my parents, for example, you know, they would watch the show on TV every week when we were on public access. Even though they were yelling at me in the video, they'd cool down.
Yeah.
You know, they'd realize that I painted their house plaid. They were angry. But then, you know, before the video aired, I painted it back.
Right.
You know, so
they, yeah.
It wasn't like I burned the house down or something.
Coming up, Tom opens up about how his cancer diagnosis led to his MTV show's premature demise and changed the course of his career forever. So the show ended after a couple of years, three seasons.
Yeah, kind of.
And so why did it end? I mean, I know it was around the time of your cancer diagnosis.
That's why it ended.
That is why it ended.
Yeah, there's sort of some misconceptions out there. Apparently, you know, some. I mean, I think there is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because the show wasn't canceled.
Yeah.
Yeah. I quit the show when I was essentially did the cancer special.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last episode of the Tom Green Show in its in its earlier form. I did do another version of the show later,
a
talk show.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't really the Tom Green Show.
That was very different.
That was a nightly talk show that we did, which we did 70 episodes of, which was really cool, and it was critically well received show too. But the show itself, the Tom Green Show, was not canceled. People sometimes, you know, think it was canceled, you know, when they talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did you think it was canceled?
No. Yeah. I mean, I
probably done a lot of research because you're a journalist.
I tried.
I've talked about that. I've tried to clarify that over the years because,
I mean,
it does matter to me that people know that the show wasn't canceled because the show, you know, it's kind of rare that a show goes out on top like that, you know.
Yeah.
Like we had the one of the number one shows on MTV. I think that was why, you know, in a lot of ways that they kind of doubled down so hard on creating content like that after, because you know, I quit, and I think they weren't actually that happy about me quitting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you know, I had a, you know, I don't know if your next question is going to ask why I quit or
I
was about to answer that question.
Well, let's just
assuming
let's go there.
You were going
yeah.
to ask that,
yeah.
But
let's just answer the question.
If you don't want the answer to that question, I can we can talk about something
else. Let's do it. Why'd you quit?
So I just had cancer. I had this massive surgery, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was this lymph node dissection, right? They cut,
yeah.
they cut your whole body open, and they were removing lymph nodes out of the back of my spine and all this stuff, and it was extremely painful. And you know, I was in
how old were you at that point?
28.
Wow,
28.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, and at the same time, I had been doing the show at this point for. 7 years, you know, only on MTV for two, but I'd been doing it for 7 years. But 2 years when you're 28 seems like a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be completely honest with you, I had major opportunities in film, you know, so I was being offered, you know, Stealing Harvard, Freddy Got Fingered, other movies that I didn't do, Road Trip, and there was just sort of huge opportunities for me, and I coupled with the fact that I just could not see myself in that physical condition where I was in a lot of pain going out on the street and falling down on the ground and running around and getting chased by people, and my life had changed, you know, my life had changed in probably the most sort of, you know, probably in a, you know, in a bigger way than, it, you know, you could really ever really sort of imagine someone's life changing in a 6 month to a year period. I went from living in my parents' basement to, you know, being very comfortable.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way.
And quite famous. I mean, I think you were on, you know, magazine covers and you were everywhere.
And I mean, depending on how, I don't like talking about money and stuff, but you know, like, I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, like, I mean, I was in this sort of situation at MTV where they weren't being totally, you know, they were still kind of not really letting us shoot what we wanted to shoot, do what we want, you know, and I had the opportunity to go make films and you know, make a really, you know, life-changing amount of money compared to what I was making at MTV. So I just made sort of a business decision, you know?
You mentioned there were other parts that you were offered that you didn't take. Is there anything that ended up being, you know, something that we would know that you turned down during that time?
Sure.
Not that you want to say here.
I don't like to say on record on a recording,
right?
Just because I don't want to like sort of disrespect the people that did take the role,
sure.
You know, because they did amazing jobs in the roles, and you know, I it's not so much that I turned down the role. It's like you always have to make a choice. It was the weirdest thing. I can tell you, if I could go back to that period in time. I probably would have done things differently.
How so?
And maybe it wouldn't have worked out as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe I wouldn't have been as happy as with the result. You know, like hindsight would affect the way I made decisions. Well, like maybe I wouldn't have made Freddy Got Fingered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had multiple films that I could have done instead of Freddy Got Fingered, and it all boiled down to
ones that you wrote.
Other people wrote. Mm-hmm. The major studios were coming to me with that major. Mm-hmm. Stars ended up doing that became huge
movies.
That did quite well. That you know.
I'm so curious what they were, but we'll have to wait on that.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, you go, okay, well, you know, how does the path of your life change? You know, okay, well, maybe if I had done those movies, I wouldn't be doing stand up today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe I would have, you know, been doing mainstream movie after mainstream movie after mainstream movie, and I would have been doing a completely different kind of thing, which on one hand, like, would have been pretty cool. But on the other hand, I don't know that I would have been as satisfied with, like, you know, creatively with what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, obviously you did Freddy Got Fingered, which...
I was getting asked to do movies, which were the movies that Freddy Got Fingered was essentially making fun of.
Right. So did you, in a way, did you feel like you preferred to make fun of it than do it?
Yeah. I mean, like there was a huge backlash to Freddy Got Fingered.
Right.
Which was not necessarily a pleasant experience for me.
Why do you think that was? Was it because people felt like they were being mocked in Hollywood?
I think that there was a lot of factors at play. There was a lot of stuff going on in my life at once.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, because of the fact that there was, you know, if I had just had my TV show and then I'd made that movie, I think it probably would have been more well received.
Mm-hmm.
But then when with a cancer thing. Mm-hmm. I was now, you know, in sort of a more of a tabloid situation too with Drew, right? I was,
yeah,
you know, like, you
Drew
know,
Barrymore.
Yeah, so there was a lot of like mainstream sort of attention to me that
you weren't an underdog.
Yeah, that may not have been there
if
I had sort of just been doing my TV show. But I think the cancer diagnosis, everything, it was like, you know, like it was when I got cancer, I was on Entertainment Tonight every night, you know, following my cancer, you know, it was like really kind of, it was sort of like, I think it probably became, you know, just a bit too much media saturation too fast. And so is my analysis of it. So that, like, you know, there wasn't this underdog sort of like, look at this crazy kid made this crazy movie. It was like, look at this, you know, let's tear this guy down a few notches.
Yeah.
I think that, that basically, it just changed the direction of where I would gone. Like if I had gone and made one of the movies that had been offered to me.
Or, and just to name one of them, no.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I had gone and done a mainstream film, right? Some of them weren't, you know, huge successes. Some of them were. But, you know, I just think that, I would have probably, you know, maybe done a few more of them. You look at anybody that's a comedian that has that kind of, they usually end up getting, you know, a run of about 5 or 10 movies and then it ends anyways, right?
Right.
So then I wouldn't have made Freddy Got Fingered, which to me now is actually a super huge bonus, you know, because, you know, I've got people that love that movie now because it is so insane, you know, it's sort of got this worldwide cult following. I mean, when I do my stand-up comedy anywhere in the world, I mean, I just toured Asia. I was just in Hong Kong, Tokyo, and Vietnam doing shows, you know. I'm telling you, there's not one day in my life in the last 15 years. This might actually sound like not a good thing, but where someone doesn't come up to me on the street and say, Daddy, would you like some sausage? Every time I leave the house,
yeah,
someone will come in Hong Kong or Sydney, Australia or Toronto. So that's from Freddy Got Fingered. So the movie couldn't have really, you know, it did resonate with people, right? Mm-hmm. Even though it may have not been, you know, critically well received.
Oh, look, honey, our boy's a genius. He's rigged a pulley system so he can eat sausage and work on his stupid drawings.
I'm being creative. Now, if you'll excuse me, I still have some work to do.
Daddy, would you like some sausage? Daddy, would you like some sausages? Daddy, would you like some sausage? Sausages, sausages.
I mean, you're very focused on stand-up now, and you put on an album and all that and interviewing. Do you still have desires to act and be in movies or television shows in that way?
Yeah, I'm developing a television show now, so we'll see what happens. I'm working with
a fictional show or a talk show.
A sitcom.
A sitcom.
Yeah, I'm actually developing and writing a sitcom right now.
And is it based on your life or?
In some ways, I probably shouldn't talk about too much right now because it's early stages. But you know, I was just on the Celebrity Big Brother show at CBS.
I did see some of that. What was that like?
It was great, and I had an amazing time on there in so many ways. I mean, it was uncomfortable, and a lot of it was not fun. Mm-hmm. But I'm somebody that kind of embraces the absurdity of that, mm-hmm. so I enjoyed, you know, living in a house with a bunch of angry people for a month. I was in there for 25 days, as long as pretty much anybody.
Yeah.
Because I made it pretty close to the end. I was voted America's favorite house guest.
Yes.
And I'm proud to say people liked me. America liked me. It's a really fun game.
Yeah. Like, it's pretty surreal just hearing you talk about it. I mean,
if you had told me when I was 16 years old and dreaming of being, you know, in television, that someday I was going to win 2 head of households and 2 golden powers of veto, I wouldn't have known what you were talking about.
Coming up, Tom explains why he actually liked Donald Trump while they were filming The Celebrity Apprentice.
How did it compare to your experience on Celebrity Apprentice?
It was very comparable, actually.
Yeah.
Very comparable. You know, the social interaction, the way people behave when they're under a microscope, mm-hmm. especially Celebrity Apprentice, Celebrity Big Brother, mm-hmm. the way celebrities, I'm doing
air
quotes,
the
way celebrities behave when they're put in an environment where not everybody is saying yes to everything they say mm-hmm. is hilarious to me.
Yeah.
People just melt down, mm-hmm. you know, so they don't know how to act when they're, you know, in a room with a bunch of people who aren't like just sort of hanging on their every word. So mm-hmm. they kind of all melt down and lose it. And it's really, really funny to observe. I kind of feel like because I kind of have done a lot of confrontational based comedy mm-hmm. in my past mm-hmm. that I was sort of a little more suited to kind of handle that kind of environment, possibly. You know, I don't think I quite melted down the way I saw people around me melting down. Mm-hmm. But it did get, you know, very emotionally taxing at points, you know. I mean, you have people screaming at you all day, and you don't see it on the show.
Yeah.
Because you're the difference between Big Brother and Apprentice, of course, is that on The Apprentice, you got to go home at the end of the day into your hotel room and the cameras weren't on you. Mm-hmm. Whereas Big Brother, it's 24 hours a day, even when you're sleeping, when you're showering.
That's insane. You know,
yeah, it's completely, completely hilarious. But I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the sort of Orwellian aspects of it. You know, mm-hmm. I found it really kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And on Apprentice, I mean, you've talked about this before, but you got fired because you went out drinking with Dennis Rodman.
I went out drinking with Dennis Rodman. Yeah, I mean, like, again, I don't know if you got all day or whatever, but mm-hmm. I can kind of give you a little bit of context to that decision too.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard you talk about it too, and we can talk about it. But it
Man,
seems
you
like
your research.
you you were kind of approaching the whole thing maybe in a different way than some of the other people in terms of trying to make it entertaining for
yeah,
the
I
audience.
Yeah, I think so. Here is my excuse for not winning Celebrity Big Brother and Celebrity Apprentice, okay? I'll give you my excuse for both. I walk into Celebrity Apprentice, and I didn't know who the other people are going to be on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And day one, I'd been doing my internet talk show at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I know a lot of people
because
I've interviewed thousands of people on my internet talk show over the years, you know. And at that point, I'd probably interviewed, you know, close to a thousand, hundreds and hundreds of people. I'd probably done 500 episodes of my show. So I knew lots of people. So I knew I was going to know somebody in there on The Apprentice. I just didn't know who it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And the everyone walks in and Andrew Dice Clay is there, who I've actually become quite close with at that point. You know, he'd done my show several times. We've had a lot of laughs. We know each other. We like each other. We're friends.
Yeah.
Since then, we've become even closer friends. But so I immediately realized, okay, this is going to affect the way I portray, the way I behave on the show, because, you know, when I'm around other comedians, especially Dice, we kind of like Dice is, you know, if you know Andrew Dice Clay, he is hilarious on and off stage, and he's always trying to kind of, I don't know, confuse people around him, which is something that I enjoy doing too. So we kind of ended up kind of like not taking the game as seriously as I would have, essentially. And he was fired in the first episode.
Yeah.
And now I was left with a group of people who had seen me goofing around, basically, and, you know, no longer were taking me seriously as a businessman, you know, as a business person.
Which is, of course, what the show is all about.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of had an impact. And then, and I was also the youngest person. And I was also the only comedian after Dice was gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, there became sort of a... and there's a, it's impossible for me when I'm on, you know, I'm on the Celebrity Apprentice and we are making cupcakes. And Clint Black and Jesse James and Brian McKnight are yelling at each other.
About the cupcakes.
About the cupcakes. It's impossible for me to not to sort of look directly into one of the cameras and just do sort of like a deadpan sort of take to the camera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that, you know, the camera can cut to me giving a look while Clint Black and Scott Hamilton are screaming at
this
each other.
It goes back to the reaction shots being the funniest part.
I'm giving my reaction shot.
Yeah.
So now they're seeing me do that.
Mm-hmm.
So now they sort of feel that I'm mocking them.
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible for me not to mock the situation.
It's a very mockable situation.
Yeah. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily ingratiate yourself to people the way, you know, like when they see, you know, again, you got Herschel Walker, Brian McKnight, Clint Black, Scott Hamilton. They're all yelling at each other. And nobody's really sort of analyzing it from a television perspective. None of them are thinking about the absurdity of the fact that they're yelling at each other. They're all actually mad at each other.
Yeah.
So when they see me kind of mocking it a little bit, which is impossible for me to not do, I think they took offense to that.
Yeah.
So now I had an alliance against me because they're thinking, oh, this guy's not taking the game seriously.
Yeah, it's got to go.
Got to go. So when I was, I stupidly volunteered to be project manager.
Mm-hmm.
In the third episode. Again, I don't know how far down the rabbit hole you want to go. They tried to get me fired in the second episode, but I got Scott Hamilton fired.
Mm-hmm,
so
you
have to go back and watch that.
Yeah.
That was pretty fun. But, you know, I think in hindsight, I would not have probably gone out drinking as late as I did and slept through my alarm. But I knew I was, I essentially knew I was going to going to lose that week anyways.
Yeah.
Tom, you're fired. Go. You were lousy last week, lousy this week. We have to do it. Go.
All right. That's fine.
That's it. Go. Get out.
That it?
Good. Okay. Go. Out.
All right. Thanks, Gus.
Try a little harder, will you, Dennis, please?
I will try.
Look, in hindsight, I probably could have gotten past it. You know, I think I've learned, full disclosure, you know, like I was pretty young. Mm-hmm. And I think I've learned as I get older that, you know, I've cut back on booze quite a bit, you know, mm-hmm. like to, you know, be serious with you for a second.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I don't drink alcohol when I'm on the road doing stand up,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I've learned that I'm just much sharper if I not only am not drinking, but if I still drink, I'm not like sober and I don't consider myself like I ever had a problem with it. But I do feel like that. You know, there's times to just be like completely straight, you know. So like I don't like to, you know, drink. Like I just was doing stand up in Nashville all weekend and I didn't have a drink until after my last show,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Just to kind of keep focused on what you need to be doing.
I just feel that when you're 47 years old, if you go out and have some drinks, even after your show on Friday night,
mm-hmm.
I'm just not as sharp on stage on Saturday night.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I do a lot of crowd work, a lot of improv, and I like to be able to pull comedy out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, my mind's not operating at the speed that it would be operating at
mm-hmm.
if I was, you know, even if I just had, I'm serious. Like, it's funny when you do stand up, you notice the difference. I've noticed the difference at which my mind operates, the speed at which I think of things.
Mm-hmm.
Even if I had one beer the
yeah.
night before.
Yeah, it affects it.
It affects it.
Wow.
And that's was sort of an eye-opener. I didn't
yeah.
even realize that until I started
mm-hmm.
really touring and doing stand-up again.
You mm-hmm.
know? Nothing worse than being on stage hungover.
Yeah.
As for a comedian.
Yeah. So just to wrap up the Celebrity Apprentice thing, I mean, the thing that's so bizarre about that experience is that the people that you were involved that you went out drinking with Dennis Rodman and then Donald Trump fired you.
Mm-hmm.
Now Trump is the president of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Rodman has kind of become our North Korean ambassador.
North Korea. Yeah. Yeah.
In some sense. So, I mean, how do you... That's a pretty surreal thing to think back at that time and now where these people that you were interacting with have come. So how do you kind of think about that now?
I mean, it is surreal to say that, you know the president of the United States. I mean, I can recall, you know, dozens of one-on-one conversations I had with him mm-hmm. in the hallway while we weren't filming
yeah.
you know, with Trump. And so that's surreal. I mean, do you want any sort of political commentary from me right now?
Because
I sort of hesitate to do it sometimes, but I find it disappointing. Some of the, you know, I do find it disappointing. You know, and that's like, you know, the kindest way I can put it,
mm-hmm.
the rhetoric that he has used, you know,
yeah.
the racial division that he has used.
I'm curious about that because
that I find so upsetting because. If it wasn't for that,
mm-hmm.
the divisive racial tone
mm-hmm.
that he has brought to the country,
mm-hmm.
if it wasn't for that, I would actually like him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, it's not like I have a problem with his, you know, the way he's aggressive on trade or the way mm-hmm. he is with so many issues.
Yeah, I mean, I did see you tweet recently about the detention camps on the border, though. That was something that you...
Yeah, that I consider,
yeah,
that under the racial
that. Yeah.
Racial thing, you know? It's like, yeah, we're blocking people from, you know, who don't
mm-hmm.
look like us
mm-hmm.
and aren't
mm-hmm.
from here, you know? So that's the racial, you know, divisiveness of his presidency. So that to me is upsetting because if it wasn't for that, you know, I mean, it, you know, I actually, you know, liked Donald
mm-hmm.
Trump. It's the reason I did the Celebrity Apprentice
yeah.
was because I thought he was funny.
Yeah.
And I thought the show was cool.
There's been a lot of rumors about his behavior on the set of that show. And I, you know, Tom Arnold did a whole special about the search mm-hmm. for the tapes of him
yeah.
supposedly using the N-word on set. Did that, is that something that you witnessed or saw or anything like that?
No, I never saw anything like that. And if I did see that, I would not have liked Donald Trump. But I
mm-hmm.
did like Donald Trump
mm-hmm.
when I was on the show. Even when he screamed at me and fired me, I liked
yeah.
it. I think that was the thing that was most disappointing about it. It was like, ah, I didn't I didn't pull it off. I didn't impress Donald Trump enough to win, you know. Mm-hmm. This was before all of this other stuff happened.
Yeah, yeah. So you see a different guy now than you knew.
I mean, I can't say I knew him well enough to have said I know him, you know. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
I think the second he came down that escalator and said, you know, what he said about, you know, Mexicans, you know, I suppose some of them are good people, you know, and all the other inflammatory things he said, was the second that I kind of took a step back and said, whoa, I didn't know you were that guy.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, and look, I'm an immigrant. Right, I just became a U.S. citizen, so I, you know, I'm from another country. I feel that, you know, immigrants contribute a lot to this country, right? Mm-hmm. I brought, you know, maybe some questionable comedy, but you know, I've paid taxes. Yeah, I've contributed to society, so I think that's a good thing to allow people to come here.
Yeah, I'm always curious about his sense of humor or lack thereof. And I know Letterman recently was talking about this and saying he used to go on the show all the time. He was able to laugh at himself. He saw that the sense of humor that is no longer present. Did you get a sense that he had was able to laugh at himself at all when you interacted with him?
I did not get that sense, actually.
Yeah. So maybe he was already.
I rode a horse into the final episode of The Celebrity Apprentice that I rented.
Mm-hmm.
Never made air.
No, because he didn't. Think
Clint Black wore his black cowboy hat every day on the show, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Clint Black was kind of particularly mean to me in the context of the game, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure he's a nice guy off camera, but you know, in the game, he was aggressively against me on the game. So, sort of for a little shits and giggles, can I swear?
Yeah.
Real tough word I used there. I just said shit.
Shits and giggles.
Yeah, and giggles. Yeah, kind of. Balances it out a bit. But I thought it'd be funny to show up and wear a black cowboy hat for the season finale. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe what I'll do is I'll actually rent a horse in Manhattan. I'll show up to Trump Tower on a horse and the camera and try to ride it into the building and the cameras will film and everyone will get all freaked out. So this was my thought process. Anyways, they didn't let me on the show with the horse. They made me take the hat off. And then later on, I was standing in the hallway with Trump and I told him I showed up on a horse that day, and he sort of had a very deadpan kind of reaction to that. Mm-hmm. I don't think he saw any sort of humor in me showing up on a horse. But that being said, you know, I mean, you know, it just all boils down to what I said. You know, I do think he has a sense of humor. I just think it's sort of, you know, he's gone to some very dark and divisive places, which I find upsetting.
Yeah. So before we start to wrap up, I want to do a little bit of a speed round kind of thing where we go through some moments in your career and just tell me the first kind of memory or thought that comes to mind.
All right.
So, you know, you mentioned that you were always a big talk show, you know, late night talk show fan. What was your first late night talk show appearance and what do you remember from that time?
In the United States?
Sure.
Yeah. The first late night talk show appearance in the United States was David Letterman, yeah.
It's just weird to be here, you know, in New York City, where I live three blocks away from here.
Right.
In a hotel. And, in a hotel. And, but that you guys picked me up in a car today and brought me here in the car. I only live three blocks away.
All right.
And it was like it's a really long car, like it's a gorgeous car, all tinted windows and everything. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask them to maybe take me around the block a few times and have a little more time in it. But...
Well, you better be very good then tonight.
Yeah. Do you think they'll
let me? Or we'd like a little something back on our transportation bill.
Okay.
That must have been a big deal for you at the time.
That was a completely out-of-body experience for me. I remember every... you know, second of it, really, leading up to it. I also remember that, like, it happened surprisingly quickly, to the point that the brass at MTV were almost could not believe it had happened. It was weeks after the show premiered, really? We got a call from Letterman. And, you know, they were thinking this was just some little show that they were doing. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we sort of, the thing rocketed up. And I was asked to do Letterman, and it was amazing. And, yeah, I remember, you know, probably equally as exciting, though, was when I, a few years later, got to host Letterman.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was amazing, yeah.
How did that happen that you got to guest host, and what do you remember from that experience?
I just got a out-of-nowhere phone call the night before I was to host, and I was in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I got a call at, you know, noon. Mm-hmm. Can you host Letterman tomorrow? And I immediately drove to the airport. Didn't pack a bag, anything.
Yeah.
And just drove to the airport and got in a plane.
Yeah.
Wrote my own monologue on the plane.
Wow. It was pretty rare for him to have guest hosts, I think, right?
He had done it a few times at that point, but it was rare, and it wasn't something that he did. I think probably, I mean, probably could count on your hands, and I think he's probably had like maybe a dozen people guest hosted in the history of the show, so. So it was something I never thought I would get to do, but it was amazing. Yeah.
Another big moment was hosting SNL in the year 2000. That was about a year into the Tom Green Show, right? I mean, what did you? What was that experience like for you?
You know, I mean, it was an amazing thing to have gotten to do it. You know, I was definitely, you know, I think if I could go back and do it again someday, I would do it a lot differently. You know, I was so, first of all, I had my friends who were from Canada who were working with me on my show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted them to be kind of included in it. So I asked SNL if my friends could come, who were writers on my MTV show, could come in and help, you know.
What'd they think of that?
They said yes.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, I asked Lorne Michaels, and he said, yeah, sure. So, but I didn't understand the politics of Saturday Night Live, and I didn't understand that potentially the writers of the show may have thought that was, and I don't even know if this is true, but I've, you know, and myself also, I was, you know, again, like I said earlier, aggressively trying to deconstruct everything that I encountered just because I was a kid in my 20s and every single thing I did, I was like, that's the way you do it. Let's try to take it apart and put it back together upside down and inside out. And so, you know, I went to SNL and, you know, I brought my friends from high school with me to help write some skits. And we ended up writing like maybe half the skits on the show. Wow. You know, my monologue, the ending of the show, and you know, a bunch of the skits on the show. And I think in hindsight, I would have rather just showed up and worked with everybody else, and which I also did, and just kind of went with the flow a bit more. But you know, I was young and passionate.
Is there a story behind the bit that you did with Drew Barrymore, the kind of wedding?
The only story I could say to that really is something that I actually regret. Okay, and I try not to have regrets, but this is something I regret. So, you know. Drew and I actually were engaged at the time, so we thought, "Oh, this will be a funny prank. We'll prank the audience, and
that you would get married.
Tell everyone we're going to get married on SNL, and then she won't show up at the altar at the end, and that'll be the punchline." You know, even though we were still getting married, and like I think like a month after we were actually getting married,
it's a funny bit.
Yeah, that was the bit. But the thing I regret about that bit to this day, which I actually I'm kind of sad about, to be honest with you, is that the way we wrote the bit, me and my friends from high school, who, you know, in some ways may have influenced me in ways that I wish, you know, when you're with your friends from high school, everyone's pushing each other to do things that they probably shouldn't do, right?
Yeah.
And so the way the bit ended was, you know, we kept teasing that we were going to get married at the end of the show. She's out in the hallway in her wedding dress. Mm-hmm. My parents are there in the audience. All everyone is there. And then at the end of the show, she doesn't show up. And I have the end of my SNL, I have a meltdown on stage when she does show up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a complete meltdown. Mm-hmm. And the band stops playing and the entire cast just disappears. And I'm standing alone on stage at the very end of the show, which is, you know, artistically and for me, I think it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But like it does sort of ruin my beautiful Saturday Night Live mm-hmm. kumbaya moment at the end of every episode of Saturday Night Live where you're hanging out with the cast mm-hmm. and celebrating together. And I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a metaphor for the, you know, rebellious, you know, naive kid that I was, where we're going to go in there and we're going to try to, mm-hmm. you know, turn SNL upside down, you know. But in the other ways, I think it probably just sort of ruined my Saturday Night Live experience in some ways.
You know? Turned it upside down to the point where you were the only one left on stage.
Only one
by
left
yourself.
On stage. I didn't get to sort of, you know, hang with the crew and the band and the cast at the end and celebrate a fun night, you know. So, but we all went to the rap party after and had a blast. So,
did everyone get that it was a joke, or were there, you know, because I know you were in the tabloids and stuff a lot then. Did anyone think that there was a real split there?
Well, first of all, it was one of the highest rated SNLs of the year, I think, because of the prank.
Yeah,
because I think people were waiting to the end.
Yeah,
to see.
Yeah, you got people. That's hard to get people sometimes.
So it was a massive success in that sense.
Yeah.
I think we did create a reason to stay up till the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I mean, people fall asleep in SNL. You know, it's late. You know, so I'm not saying they fall asleep in SNL, but you know, I mean, sometimes you don't make it to the end.
Yeah.
People get tired. So it was a highly rated show. But so what was the question?
Oh, I was curious if anyone thought that meant that you guys were done after that. If you fooled anyone with your prank, or if it was pretty obvious that it was a joke.
I think so. I think it confused some people.
Yeah.
I mean, I to put in perspective how bizarre my life was. Not, I mean, this is a show, right? You want me to talk about myself?
Yeah.
Like, it's a show about me, right?
This is all about you.
Like, you want me to talk about myself?
Right. Right. Right.
Sometimes I hesitate telling too many stories about myself because I feel like I might come off a little like sort of affected or whatever.
Yeah. Don't worry about that.
But that's the whole point, right?
Right.
If I didn't talk about myself, then like you wouldn't have a...
Yeah. We're not talking about me.
Yeah. Okay. We could if you want. I could interview you.
No, it's fine.
So, but just to put it in perspective of how crazy my life was at that time, which I sometimes think how bizarre life is. Saturday Night Live... After that happened, the next day, you know, Drew mm-hmm. and I got on a plane to London
mm-hmm.
where we went to have dinner with Prince Charles at St. James Palace with 12 other people for the royal premiere of Charlie's Angels, which was, you know, premiering the movie was coming out. So that's how I met Drew. I met Drew when we did Charlie's mm-hmm. Angels. So. Mm-hmm. So that movie was now coming out, and we were... you know, together. And we went and had dinner with Prince Charles, you know, mm-hmm. just 10 of us.
Yeah.
You know, in a little room. In a room, you know, with like in St. James Palace with like guns and swords on the wall. And I sat with Camilla Parker Bowles for the entire dinner.
As you do.
And had a 2-hour long chat with Camilla Parker Bowles.
Do you remember what you talked about?
Yeah, we talked about stuff like France and mm-hmm. stuff. And how the food? I remember we were talking about how a nephew of theirs had just come back from Brazil. We talked a lot about organic farming. Talked a lot about Prince Charles liked to talk about organic farming. Mm. So we talked about that, and I talked about Peter Sellers with Prince Charles.
Oh,
he loved. He was friends of Peter Sellers.
That's cool.
So Charles and I talked about Peter Sellers and Monty Python some of them had seen Road Trip, so we talked about, you know, if it was it a real mouse, you know, like literally Prince Charles asked me if it was a real mouse, you know.
That's hilarious. So,
which it was. So it was a bizarre time in my life. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'd say to put it you know, I guess I said it already about SNL, but I think if I ever got the opportunity to do that again, you know, which would be nice to someday do that again, you know, I would love to be able to not bring my friends from high school in and just go in and you know, sort of do a Saturday Night Live episode, not try to make it some crazy warped episode.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah.
But I mean, looking back, it's a unique Saturday Night Live episode because you were the host.
Yeah, and it was. Yeah. The naivety of youth, right? Yeah. I don't think I quite caught on early enough. You know, like I had been so like I had been so hell-bent on causing chaos everywhere that I went. That was that all of a sudden when I was, you know, where I was, I still was behaving as if I was living in my parents' basement trying to, like, you know, I should have probably taken certain opportunities to go on some of these things and just kind of, you know, be grateful that I was there, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't really kind of realize that at the time, you know? But, you know, look, I mean, I don't regret anything in the SNL episode other than just that last moment. I wish we had not played it out like that. You know?
The one other thing I did want to ask you about is this little incident that happened with Martin Short as Jiminy Glick, that he talked about how you're the only one who ever walked out on Jiminy Glick.
Yeah.
What? How do you think about that now? Because it's now, you know, I think 15 years later or something.
Well, I don't really like to make a, you know, habit of talking about this because you know I love Martin Short.
Yeah,
like Martin Short is
your fellow Canadian comic.
I was my you know, literally one of my greatest inspirations in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like watching SCTV. So, you know, you grow up in Canada, you want to be a comedian. You know, Martin Short
totally
is the guy. But I had just gone through my cancer surgery, and I was. Not only was I physically in a lot of physical pain when I was on the show, but I was also, you know, I mean, depending how far down, into the weeds we want to get here, you know, I was, you know, very physically and emotionally affected by my cancer surgery to the point that I had sort of drop in energy level. I could even say some depression and drop in sort of physical sort of energy, you know, and also was very upset about it. And so, you know, again, without like kind of, I don't want to make this sound like I'm mad at him.
No.
But he did sort of go after me about my testicular cancer. He was making fun of my one ball and all this stuff.
And you didn't think it was funny?
I didn't. I was upset. I was upset by it. And so, like, you know, I think that kind of sort of was, there's a thing that happens when you have testicular cancer and then you make a television show about it and you're a comedian where I think you say to the world, hey, it's all right to make fun of this because I'm making fun of it.
Right.
And I think sometimes people don't really understand that it's actually not all right to make fun of it. It's only all right to make fun of it if you're making fun of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So when I joked around about it on the cancer special, you know, I was making fun of myself in order to sort of deal with the terrifying reality that I was potentially going to die, you know, from cancer.
Yeah.
So it was a very scary experience. So I've had, you know, again, not to talk about, you know, one of my heroes, the legendary Martin Short, because it was just sort of an awkward moment, you know, that was a short moment in time that ended. You know, I will say that I've had multiple occasions over the years and it where people come up and say, like, how's your ball doing, man? You know, like I'm telling you, like it happens all the time.
That's
and
crazy.
So for the first several years of that, I would get very upset, you know, because I was sort of still grappling with the reality of it. Mm-hmm. Not the fact that I had one testicle removed. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm fine with that. Like, yeah. it's nothing to do with that. Just the sort of the minimalization of how serious cancer is for mm-hmm. someone. You know, like you would never go up to somebody who had any other form of cancer mm-hmm. and say, "You, how's this going?" or "How's yeah. that?" and mention the body part that they'd yeah. had removed and make yeah. a big loud joke about
well,
it.
Well, I think it's also because it was you.
Because it was me. Yeah. Because I talked about it. Because it is a testicle. And mm-hmm. because people perceive that as funny, mm-hmm. I think people have often made the mistake of making a joke about it. Mm-hmm. And there was a period in my life where I reacted honestly mm-hmm. when people did that. Now when people come up to me and say, "How's your ball doing?" which happens, I would say, at least once a week,
wow.
I don't react honestly.
Mm-hmm.
I just say, "It's not too good, actually. It's rotting away in a medical facility somewhere in Southern California. But the other yeah. one's all right. Thanks for asking." And I don't get mad because mm-hmm. I just realize people just don't know yeah. what they're doing.
Yeah. But it still does upset you on some level.
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah. So the last thing before we end, I end every interview by asking, what's the last thing that made you laugh really hard? You could think about it kind of as like a recommendation for listeners, something that they could watch or see, something that really made you laugh.
I really loved Nate Bargatze's stand-up special.
Mm, yeah.
Who I interviewed recently on Larry King.
Oh,
now
yeah.
on Larry King
Very
Now.
Cool.
I thought he had a great special. I really enjoyed it. There's a lot of stand-ups I think mm-hmm. are great right now because I'm down at the Comedy Store, you know, several times a month I'll go down mm-hmm. there. And when I'm in L.A. and at home, I'll go down and do stand-up at the Comedy Store or the Laugh Factory or the Improv. So I'm always around, like, really great comics. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I'll be jumping up on stage. Dane Cook will be there or Arsenio Hall was there last week.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, you're around all these really, you know, legendary people. Bill Burr mm-hmm. and so I love great stand-up comedy and I love watching, you know, great comics and so some of those people I just mentioned have been making me yeah. laugh a lot lately. You know, Dane came and did an episode of Larry King Now also.
Oh, nice.
And he's just we had some funny moments on the show because he also informed me that he has had one testicle as himself.
Oh, wow.
Undescended testicle. So we had a funny moment that he brought it up. But as outside of that, outside of stand up, I'm trying to think of some shows and things that I've watched. I like a lot of stuff, you know, but I tell you, like, when I talk about stuff that I watch on TV, some of it isn't that funny.
Yeah.
Like, I just really enjoyed Chernobyl.
Oh, yeah.
So there wasn't a lot of laughs in that.
No, very few.
Yeah.
But very good.
But I love that. I got to interview Jared Harris for Larry King last week,
actually. He's incredible.
And so that was great. I laugh at everything, you know, mm-hmm. that if I see a comedy that everyone likes, I usually like it, you know?
Yeah.
But there's no, I'll tell you, I mean, you see, it's taken me a long time to give you an answer. The thing about performing and writing and doing comedy every day, and then you couple that with getting older, mm-hmm. it just takes a lot to really surprise you.
Yeah.
And so I don't have those kinds of like, laughs that I used to have
mm-hmm.
when I was 14 years old and seeing Monty Python's, you know, Meaning of Life for the first time, and you know, we're here to take your liver, but I'm still using it, and I'm like, as they're ripping the guy's liver, I'm like literally can't breathe,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
you know, because I'm so shocked and amazed at the absurdity of it, and I'd never seen anything like mm-hmm. it. You know, there's not a lot that really when I watch people doing comedy now, I'm almost analyzing it with more of I'm more taking it apart and putting it back together in my head.
Yeah.
And so
I hear that from comedians a lot. It almost feels like homework or something to,
yeah.
to
I still
to
laugh,
watch
though. I do still laugh. Like, I mean, you know, if I watch Eric Andre, I'm going to laugh. You
yeah.
know, if I watch, I'm forgetting the name of the show. I wanted to say, I did want to give you an answer, and it was I was about to give you the answer, but I'm embarrassed I forget the name of the show. It's the guy from Lonely Island who has the new show on Netflix.
The guy
and
from
it's
Lonely...
a sketch show.
Oh, I don't, well.
Is he from Lonely
no,
Island?
No, well, are you thinking of Tim Robinson?
Yeah, is he not from Lonely
no,
Island?
No, not from, not oh. from, but he was a SNL writer.
SNL writer.
Yeah, I think you should
why
leave.
Do I think he's from Lonely Island?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, he's from SNL then. Did he write Dick in a Box or something like that?
I don't think so.
Well, anyways,
but
I like that show.
But he wrote some good stuff, yeah. I think you should leave. That's been actually the most popular.
I've never met him. I don't know him, but I like that show. I think that's funny. I watched the first episode of it and was definitely very amused.
All right.
Take
the
part out where I don't know that he was from.
We'll go. Yeah, we'll.
Let me say it again. What's that show called?
I Think You Should Leave.
Yeah. One show I really like right now is that show, I Think You Should Leave. No, I do love that show.
Yeah.
No, you can leave it in, I guess. keep it real.
All right. Thanks, Tom, so much. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, man.
Thank you again to Tom Green for all of the great stories on today's episode. You can find his tour dates at tomgreen.com, and he also recently released an album called The Tom Green Show, which is only available on vinyl and can be ordered at the link in the show notes for this episode. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith for... The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!